Hello, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 414. This week, the questions are taken from guides 488 and 489 on the pre-dreadnought battleship New Jersey and the armored cruiser Warspite, the Wednesday videos on USS Salmon and terrible naval plans, and the Friday videos on radio-controlled battleships and how to tell how fast a ship is moving just using a photo. So let's begin. Josh Thomas Moore asks, Battle of the Punching Bags, which ship was more structurally sound, the Königsbergs or the Courageous class? And who's more protected, a Courageous class or an Invincible class? The protection issue is quite easily answered. The Invincible class, for all its other faults, is about twice as well protected as a Courageous class. Courageous class is basically proof against destroyer caliber gunfire or maybe long-range light cruiser gunfire. You know what I mean when I say light cruiser gunfire, even though that's not technically an official definition in World War One, nonetheless. Whereas the Invincibles had armor protection, which at least would keep them safe at reasonable ranges against armored cruiser gunfire, which is a significant step up from the Courageous class. But in terms of being structurally sound, between the Königsbergs and the Courageouses, I think in that case I would actually have to give it to the Courageous class. They are just a little bit more massive. Yes, they did damage themselves when they fired 15-inch guns. And yet they weren't necessarily the best at running through extremely high seas in storms with the relatively flimsy hull that they were given. However, the Courageous class could and did sail through North Sea storms and the occasional foray out into the Atlantic without people panicking and wondering if they were ever going to come back. Whereas with the Königsbergs, well, they did do a few overseas expeditions, but then when you look at what happened as a result of those, the German Navy, or the Kriegsmarine eventually, but originally the Reichsmarine, never really considered sending them out into deep water for wartime operations. They sent the Hippers, they sent the Deutschlands, they even off of the Bay of Biscay sent destroyers, but you will never see a Königsberg doing anything other than coastal work, you know, going up to Norway and so forth, or toodling around in the Baltic. Almirante Brown asks, if Imperial Germany had adopted the Japanese practice of building armoured cruisers with battleship-grade guns, like the Ibuki class, how would that have influenced the first Battle of the Falkland Islands if von Spee's squadron had included a pair of those vessels? Do you think the Royal Navy would have dispatched more than two battlecruisers to deal with two Ibuki-style German armoured cruisers that were armed with four 11-inch guns and eight 8.2-inch guns? I think the Royal Navy still would have sent just the two battlecruisers to deal with them. However, I think the battlecruisers themselves would have been of a somewhat different design. Now, the reason I say that is while the Tsukubas and Ibukis were designed and laid down only very shortly after the Scharnhorsts, the designs for those ships were switched over to having 12-inch guns by the Japanese at very short notice towards the end of 1904. Plus, of course, Japan was an ally of Britain, and Britain looked at them and went, well, one, they're allied ships, two, the Invincible class have twice as many big guns and are considerably faster. So there wasn't an immediate need to redesign the Invincibles as a result. The design process for the Scharnhorst, however, and what was publicly known about them, took somewhat longer. And of course, the Scharnhorst were seen as a much more considerable threat. Well, the German Navy as a whole was. And therefore, my suspicion is that if Fisher knows what the Scharnhorst are going to be like, given that the first of the Scharnhorst is laid down at the end of 1904, and they don't have to start building the Invincibles until 1906, they almost certainly would have revised the layout of the Invincibles in light of the news coming out of Germany. Because while, yes, the Invincibles with eight guns, although really practically a six-gun broadside, would have some slight firepower advantage at long range over the Scharnhorsts and a speed advantage, armour would be about the same. So I think Fisher, looking at that, would have become more concerned about how they might fare in battle against these new German ships, and he might have gone for one of the alternate armament layouts that were considered for the Invincibles and potentially looked to give them a heavier broadside and or more armor, etc., just to, you know, edge them towards being a superior design compared to the Invincibles and obviously compared to these revised German ships. The other thing, of course, is that even if it was considered to be too late for the Invincibles, you then have things like the X4 design, the kind of hybrid pseudo-fast battleship that Fisher proposes and gets shot down as a successor to the Invincibles. And if the Germans start off with these kind of semi-battle cruisers, he may get a little bit more weight behind arguing for that, at which point, if he does, then instead of a revised Invincible, if they've got, you know, a class of X4 type semi-fast battleships, they might send a couple of those down instead. Rambling Reaver asks, while the drawbacks to grafting an entire extra gun turret on the roof of a primary battery is obvious, just how much more tonnage would ships like USS New Jersey actually have needed to make them have a more sane super-firing layout? Were there any technical challenges that might have stopped this? I recall that HMS Dreadnought had design features that would have complicated their super-firing systems if they'd had them, even if Fisher hadn't been hell-bent on having a 6-gun forward battery. Well, there would have been some additional weight implications to having an extra barbette, as opposed to using the 12-inch turrets as the barbettes. And of course, then you also need additional rotational machinery and everything, rather than just welding a hat onto the existing 12-inch turrets. But with all that said, the displacement of the Virginia class, which New Jersey BB-16 is part of, was somewhat lower than some of the other pre-dreadnoughts that were being built at that time. It was higher than some of the previous US pre-dreadnoughts, but that's because Congress had been really, really tight on funding. Now they were being slightly less tight on funding. So if they'd gone from, say, 13,500 tons, which is what the Virginias were ostensibly designed for, up to, say, 15,000 plus tons, which would be something like a contemporary, like a King Edward VII, they could have used that to make the ship's hull a little bit longer, which would have given them a bit more space along the center line to put turrets. If you look at the overall layout, there's arguably some space aft where you could have a super firing twin eight ahead of the rear 12-inch twin, so closer to amidships. But I think you would need a bit of extra length on the bow to buy yourself enough space to have a super firing twin eight forwards as well. You could also perhaps buy some space and displacement and allow for rearrangement of things by maybe suppressing some of the secondary battery, because you've got to remember it's not just those 8-inch guns. You've also got 6-inch guns, 3-inch guns, 3-pounders, etc. So, and you've got the additional twin turrets on either side. So if they'd played around a little bit with that and instead gone for perhaps maybe knock off a 2 or 4 of the secondary battery, or the tertiary battery technically at that point, because the secondary battery is the 8-inch, then I think they might have been able to salvage a bit more out of the situation as well. Chris Reiter asks, when and why did Navy stop building or ordering ships with fabulous bow and stern ornamentation? It varies slightly from Navy to Navy, but the drop in really big bow and stern ornamentation kind of starts in the late 1860s, early 1870s. In part because ships' bow structures are changing as sail, and thus the bowsprit becomes more auxiliary and then eventually fades out completely. But it's still there, just somewhat reduced in size. You can see here this is USS Iowa BB-4 in 1898, and she still has some bow ornamentation. It's just not as large or spectacular as you see in early periods. So it's kind of fading out during the ironclad and into the early steel period. But it's still there. And when it kind of has its very last gasp, outside of somewhere like the Japanese, who still put the chrysanthemum on the bow of their big ships, is essentially the mid to late 1890s going into the early 1900s. For the Royal Navy, there's still a fair amount of bow ornamentation on their last ironclads, And you see it in patches on things like the Royal Sovereigns, the Majestics, the early pre-dreadnoughts. But by the time you get to the turn of the century, it's basically disappeared for the most part. For the US Navy, they keep the bow ornamentation on for a bit longer. You can see plenty of photos of ships in the 1900s that still have it. But even with those ships, they gradually lose it over the early 1900s. And by the time you get to the end of the 1900s, going into the 1910s, pretty much everyone has lost the bow ornamentation, apart from places where it's a bowsprit on a training ship or something like that. Or under the bowsprit, I should say, the figurehead and things like this. As for why, it was essentially seen as, became, it started to be seen as an expensive thing that wasn't really necessary anymore and would have to be removed anyway in times of war. As well as, again, with the changes in bow shapes and the increase in ship's speed, anything that you put on the bow, if you were driving along at 16, 18 knots consistently in high seas, it was going to get damaged and destroyed in pretty short order anyway. So there's kind of a practical side to it as well. Captain Seafort asks, every account of war spite and imperieuse I've seen only gives their length between perpendiculars at 315 feet. Do you know how long they were overall? And why is it that overall length appears to be missing from the records that these accounts are based on? I don't imagine any captain would be particularly happy if the paperwork told him his ship was 315 foot long. He'd then try to take her into 325 foot dry dock and then discovered she didn't quite fit. So I broke out an overall plan, and if you're going from the very tip of the ram bow to the very aft of the stern, up on the poop deck or the quarter deck, depending on how you're defining it. Anyway, that gives you an overall length of 345 feet, so 30 feet longer than the perpendicular length from the stem post or the rudder post all the way to the front of the bow. As for why that length isn't included, I think, to be honest, it's probably just a case of what the Victorian engineers actually bothered writing down. And then, obviously, what's also survived through to this day. And also, to be honest, generally speaking, if you're going in for a very tight-fitting dry dock, you'd go in for something like the Bermuda floating dry dock, where the ends are open, so a slight bit of projection doesn't matter too much anyway. And if you're going into an enclosed dry dock, you generally try and leave quite a considerable distance between your bow and stern and the ends of the dry dock. So at that point, it wouldn't matter massively, but I suspect the overall length figure was available at the time. It's just perhaps not survived through to the records that are used for our most common reference works these days. Long Lakeshore asks, how much did steam engines, and especially funnels, affect the placement of masts and the overall efficiency of sailing rigs? Did anyone ever measure it, or did it simply not matter given the advantages of steam propulsion? Initially, it didn't affect the placement of masts and such like too much, because steam engines were still very much an auxiliary and sail was the primary means of propulsion, and therefore they were going to prioritize sail. There was some minor effect because, of course, you would want to put your big, heavy, high volume boilers as close to the ship's center as possible, because both for trim reasons and also because that's the largest portion of the ship, volumetrically speaking. But overall, at least at first, if you look at, say, the mast layout of the Orlando and Mersey, the frigates upon which design Warrior was very heavily based, and compare them side by side with the sail plan of Warrior, you'll see that actually, despite the fact Warrior has engines and boilers, not a huge amount has really changed about the layout of the mast and rigging. But as time goes on and steam engines become more and more dominant and in use longer and longer, and the use of sail becomes more and more of an auxiliary, then you start to see the placement of the funnels, the placement of the engines, etc., starts to take an understandable priority over exactly where the masts are going to go. So you look here at Imperieuse, obviously one of the last of the cruisers to have any kind of significant sailing rig, at least the big cruisers, and you can see that compared to a cruiser or a third rate or whatever it is, or a big frigate, whatever you wanted to call it, from 10, 15, even 20 years before her, there's one less mast. So that's quite a big change. And also the placement of those masts is not anything close to what you would use as the optimal layout for those masts. If you know, and without going into huge amounts of detail about the design and how you would place masts and so forth, you know, you can look at the early ironclads that have masts and also the late era wooden ships that have auxiliary steam engines. And you can tell very quickly that the foremast position has changed a little bit, but as well as losing a mast, that main mast position has changed quite radically. LJ asks, Hydrank, how do they prevent corrosion on deck guns on submarines? I'm more curious about the Orlikans, since it seems that that would be a very complicated mechanism. There were a variety of measures that were used. So first off would be several layers of very heavy-duty, hard-wearing marine-grade paint. Also, as you can see with this U-boat deck gun, any openings into the main mechanisms, like, you know, the barrel, muzzle, etc., would be sealed with pressure-resistant caps or tampions. You would also have very liberal applications of grease and other water-resistant, usually petrochemical-based lubricants, which kept the water away, hydrophobic stuff. Also, very often, the underlying metal would be chromed, which helped, because obviously that's very, very corrosion-resistant. And on submarine-intended guns, you would also sometimes find certain parts of mechanisms, particularly in terms of training mechanisms and so forth, would be made out of brass or bronze, again, because they're corrosion-resistant, rather than steel. Now, obviously, again, that did make it more expensive, but by minimizing the use of steel to only incredibly high-pressure elements of the gun, and then chroming those, and combining with all the other methods of preservation mentioned, it would significantly impair the development of rust and corrosion, which basically the same thing, on submarine deck guns of all sorts of shapes and sizes. Plus, of course, when the sub was on the surface, the guns would be checked, rechecked, and have expendable things like grease and so forth reapplied. B2 Tall asks, was there enough US Navy submarine activity in the Atlantic during World War II to talk about? There wasn't a huge amount. The single largest element of US submarine activity on the Atlantic, was primarily commissioning and training new submarines. Because, of course, submarines were being built on the Great Lakes, being brought out into the Atlantic. Submarines were being built on the Atlantic seaboard. And there were various US Navy submarine bases there. So using the Atlantic, certainly the western side of it, and the Caribbean as an area to work up new subs, you know, get the crews familiar, et cetera, in relative safety, was the largest part of US submarine activity in that ocean. In terms of non-training elements, there are essentially three parts. One was early on, deployments of US submarines to the Caribbean to help protect the Panama Canal, because there were worries about Axis attacks on both sides of the Panama Canal. Two, during the initial period of the US entering the war and the Germans going after US shipping on the East Coast, because of a lack of many other anti-submarine assets, the US Navy actually did implement anti-submarine patrols, where they put subs out hoping to catch German U-boats on the surface and sink them, which didn't have a huge amount of success, but considering how short the US Navy was on anti-submarine warfare assets at the time, it was probably better than nothing. Of course, it did run the risk of friendly fire somewhat. And finally, in 1942, I believe, there was a short-lived submarine Squadron 50, which was actually based over on the eastern side of the Atlantic, over in the UK, and that was a small squadron of US submarines that conducted a bunch of war patrols off the coast of occupied France, but didn't have a huge amount of success in that role, and those subs were redeployed to the Pacific after a relatively short period of time. Gare M4B, says, why was the crush depth of USS Salmon so much deeper than what was calculated by the builders of the sub? Basically, it comes down to a combination of luck and good construction. because obviously you can't take a submarine down to test its crush depth, because if you've got it even slightly wrong, you lose your sub. And as they found out with Salmon, you take a submarine to a near its crush depth and you get permanent hull deformation to the point it becomes almost uneconomical to repair in most cases. So what the US Navy would do is, based on the thickness of the pressure hull and the tests on the material the pressure hull was made of and various other calculations, they would work out a theoretical crush depth. So that would just be a calculated value. And then the test depth would be rated as 2/3 of that. And that would be the depth that they would take the sub down to, just to verify that things were okay. The Royal Navy had a slightly different way of doing things. The Royal Navy test depth was 0.57 of the calculated crush depth. So that's why sometimes you'll see the rated or test depth, depending on how you want to define it, of a Royal Navy submarine might seem a little bit shallower, but that's because they were using a bigger safety factor. Anyway, getting back to Salmon. The thing with Salmon is, of course, she has this calculated value. She's got a test depth of 250 feet, a crush depth on paper of around 375 to 400 feet. And of course, parts of her get down to about 500 feet. But she survives, only just, but she still does. Now, as I said, there can be a few reasons for that. Firstly, you have to take into account local environmental factors, because things like temperature, salinity, etc., can very slightly affect the overall pressure that water exerts at a given depth. Not by much, but it can make a little bit of a difference. But also, it just comes down to how well manufactured was Salmon, because, as I said, the crush depth calculation was theoretical, and all it would take would be some particularly strong welds or rivets on the pressure hull as opposed to standard, or a batch of steel that was, you know, quality control wise was 5%, 10%, 15% better than the standard that it had to pass, which would be the value that they calculated everything on, or just the hull, the plates making up the pressure hull being perhaps just a fraction thicker, because again, there are tolerances involved, and those are plus and minus tolerances. So you could, for Salmon, in theory, have had a very well-constructed sub with a unusually high-quality batch of steel that just happened to have been made into plates that were just a little bit thicker than the theoretical thickness that was called for. And all of that would combine to give you a submarine that would have a calculated crush depth of one value, but a actual crush depth that was perhaps considerably greater than that, if you ended up in a situation where you actually had to test it, which of course Salmon did in fact end up in. And to be perfectly honest, the other thing that can sometimes make a difference is the internals, because of course the calculations are based on the actual structural elements, the bracing, the frames, the hull plating, etc. But once you've put in all the pipework, the bulkheads and all the other bits and pieces that go inside a submarine pressure hull, but those themselves, in the right circumstances, will lend a certain amount of strength to the pressure hull. It's not, again, not a huge amount. You can't really calculate for it. But if you roll all your dice when you're building a sub like Salmon and they all come up fives and sixes, you can end up with a submarine with a considerably greater amount of endurance at depth than the on-paper calculations say. Redosaurus asks, how effective was the US Navy's Mousetrap anti-submarine multi-rocket launcher compared to the Hedgehog multi-spigot mortar? In specific like-for-like terms, i.e. what happens if you get hit by a Mousetrap projectile compared to a Hedgehog projectile, they're exactly the same because they're using exactly the same projectile. It's a 65-pound projectile with 30 to 35 pounds of Torpex in it. It doesn't make any difference, really, for a sub whether you're hit by one or the other. The effect's going to be pretty much identical. However, in terms of actually getting that hit in the first place, it's a bit of a mixed bag. In absolutely objective terms, if you're comparing a ship equipped with Hedgehog to a ship equipped with Mousetrap, the Hedgehog launcher is by far the more effective, simply because the Mousetrap launcher only comes in launchers that have four rails, as you can see here, or eight rails. Whereas obviously a Hedgehog mortar, if you've seen that, has lots and lots of projectiles being launched. So a Hedgehog mortar can cover a wider area and therefore has a statistically far greater chance of actually hitting something. And they can all be fired not necessarily simultaneously, but very, very quickly, whereas the individual projectile rate of fire on a mousetrap is just a little bit slower. So if you have a ship with a Hedgehog launcher and a ship with two or three mousetrap launchers, the Hedgehog launcher is, generally speaking, going to be far more effective in taking down subs. The difference, and the reason why the US developed the mousetrap in the first place, is that the Hedgehog launcher is a big spigot launcher setup, like you said. So when you're firing a bunch of spigot mortars, that creates quite a lot of stress, quite a lot of force, which means, A, you need the area on deck to mount a Hedgehog launcher in the first place, and the deck has to be strong enough to withstand the shock of launching all those projectiles. The mousetrap system is rocket-powered, so as long as you've got a little blast plate or something, you don't need to strengthen the deck, which means that you can, in theory, put mousetrap launchers on ships that can't support Hedgehog launchers. And, of course, you can put them in lots of different areas. So you obviously normally would put them near the bow, but you don't have to. You could put them at different angles in different parts of the ship, pointing in different directions. So the mousetrap system is lighter and easier to install, and that's its main advantage. But in terms of, if you have a ship and it is armed with, say, three mousetrap launchers or a single Hedgehog launcher, the Hedgehog's just going to be a flat-out better system. But you're obviously paying for that in extra weight. Warrant Officer 2528 asks, are there any particular examples during this period, or the period the channel covers, of a ship name, like Enterprise, that has multiple highly successful members to it? I mean, Warspite's had a pretty good history. There have been quite a few Warspites in the Royal Navy, going all the way back to the time of the Armada. And while not all Warspites have had as notable a career as the Queen Elizabeth class Warspite, it is actually a relatively notable name, in as much as there have been quite a number of Warspites, but none of them have ever been lost in battle or otherwise lost at sea. They've always been able to serve throughout their career and then either be taken to the breakers or retired off to other uses. So there's never been a war loss or a service loss of a Warspite, which is quite impressive considering that, as I said, there's been a fair number of them, and each Warspite tends to have a fairly long career in one way, shape or form. Chris Reiter asks, could you describe in brief one runner-up harebrained naval plan that didn't make the cut for the video on five of the worst naval plans? And two, are you planning a video on your top five harebrained naval inventions? As far as top five harebrained naval inventions, I have a vague recollection of having done a video like that way back in the past, but I could be wrong. If I haven't, then sure, that could go on the list at some point. As far as harebrained naval plans that didn't make it into the video, I would think there was a collective one for Churchill's obsession with sacrificing the R-class, because there's a disturbing number of schemes that Churchill proposes, particularly in World War II, over the course of the war, all of which seem to involve making some kind of minor modification to one or more R-class battleships and then sailing them into insane situations with the objective of either deliberately sinking them in place or with the idea of them doing a lot of damage, but it being considered it very likely that they're going to be sunk and therefore they should be scuttled in a place that would be advantageous. And sometimes the scheme sounds sort of halfway workable, and other times when it's a bit like, you know, oh, we want you to go and shoot up Bardia in the Mediterranean, but also scuttle a revenge class in there, you're looking at it going, but why? I mean, sure, Bardia's nice, it's important, but it's not worth sacrificing a battleship over. So yeah, collectively, Churchill's various attempts to kill the R-class, I think, would fit into that. Ed Mann asks, if you shrunk an actual battleship down to 144th scale, so gun caliber, projectile mass, propellant volume, armor thickness, etc., what kind of things would change dramatically because of the square cube law? Could a pair of 1 to 144th scale battleships have a standoff fight at 100 yards? I mean, theoretically, because, I mean, a 16-inch gun, you'd be down to just over 2 mil at that scale, which is, you know, that's smaller than your average BB gun, but there are black powder, I hesitate to use the word firearms, but there are black powder projectile launchers that are of that kind of scale and could reach out to 100 yards. But the much bigger problem you would have is the wind, because certain elements of hull plating, particularly bow and stern plating, superstructure plating, if it was all scaled down to 1:144 scale because of the square cube law, would be thinner than tin foil. At which point, just whatever wave action there was on the sea or on the lake that you were on, or even a strong breeze or a particularly virulent leaf, might just start punching holes in your ship. The actual armor itself is only going to be a couple of mil maximum. But to be honest, if you're firing little, 2 mil-ish BBs at it, that might actually survive that. At least, as I say, the armor plating would. But your ship would probably just structurally collapse. It'd be a competition to see whether it would just collapse under its own weight or whether it would just sink outright, because the weight of the steel involved still in things like the armor plate, the gun turrets, and the machinery, etc., is going to be probably significantly more than the ship now displaces. HMS King George V asks, what are the differences between the Spanish Canarias class and their basis, the County class, including the various subclasses? The different style of upper works and the layout of the uptakes is obvious, but are there more subtle changes that aren't so widely known in the English-speaking world? Well, some of the other changes, somewhat obviously from the massive single funnel, the machinery was rearranged, but the Canarias class also had slightly more powerful machinery, which meant that they could go a little bit faster, around about 33 knots, so a knot to a knot and a half faster than the average County class. They were also slightly longer and slightly thinner in hull, but as you can probably see from this photo, they also had a small degree of anti-torpedo protection. So the hull width, the beam, was a bit narrower than the average County, but the actual beam, including the anti-torpedo protection, was a little bit wider. They also had a different secondary battery. Obviously, both the Counties and the Canariuses have 4 twin 8-inch turrets, but whereas the Counties go for 4-inch anti-aircraft guns, the Canariuses go for 4.7-inch guns, which are pushing more towards dual purpose than just purely anti-air. They also carry more torpedoes and slightly more protection across the belt by default than the standard layout Counties as built, but less protection than the refitted Counties once the Counties that actually have their refits done have their full belts installed. Lorenzo Zolesi asks, who would get picked to be on HMS Agamemnon when a bombing or strafing run was initiated when she was a radio-controlled target ship? Seems like a very hazardous job. Well, as a radio-controlled target ship, Agamemnon had a very much reduced crew. So you didn't need anyone to crew the weaponry, and that cuts down massively. You didn't need multiple shifts of crew because she wasn't going to be out at sea for days on end. So that cuts down, again, on the numbers. And even with the machinery reduced, you didn't need as many people in the engineering crew. So you actually had essentially a small engineering crew for the machinery, a small group of people to supervise the radio control mechanisms, and a very small command crew. So small number of people. And in the initial tests, when they still wanted somebody on board just in case something went wrong and they needed to be able to fix it quickly, basically the entire crew that were aboard as she sailed would remain on board, but they would retreat down into the ship's citadel. As I think I mentioned in the video, that a section of the ship's citadel was specially strengthened as well, so that ultimately lightweight bomb and strafing attacks probably wouldn't have gotten that deep into the ship anyway, but just in case there was some bit of extra protection. By the time they were happy with the way the ship ran, and it was time to shoot it with major caliber shells that may actually punch into the citadel and cause damage even to crew who are sheltering, by that point they'd gotten to a stage where they were happy for it to run pretty much entirely automated and the crew would withdraw by boat before it went out and got shot at. The man formerly known as Commenting Is What I Do asks, you've previously mentioned vessels that ended up going faster than their design speed. What class had the greatest increase in its actual speed versus its design speed? Well, You do have to define a couple of things. Firstly, you've got to look at proportional versus actual speed, because of course, if, say, you design a ship for 20 knots and it does 23 knots, and you design a ship for 30 knots and it does 33 knots, they're both 3-knot increases in speed. But proportionally, the ship that you designed for 20 knots and goes at 23 has exceeded its design speed by a larger factor than the ship that was designed for 30 and goes 33. So that's one thing. The other thing is you've got to desperately try and avoid situations where it is blatantly obvious that the power in question is cheating horribly. So, for example, with the German battlecruisers, we know for a fact that their trials were done in completely artificial conditions. The ships were running light, they were running in very favourable water conditions, very favourable depths, with abnormally high quality fuel and extremely well trained engineers and stokers on board. So yeah, shockingly at that point, the absolute perfect combination of circumstances, which just flat out not going to happen in regular service, let alone wartime, yeah, they can go significantly faster than their design speed. But that's just flat out not realistic or a fair test at all. You know, if you put any number of ships in those kinds of conditions, they would also have ridiculous speeds in excess of their trials, or their design speed at least. But I think in terms of an overall class that has a significant increase in actual speed versus design speed, it's going to be pretty difficult to compete with the Le Fantasque class, some of the French super destroyers or contre-torpilleurs, because they were ostensibly designed for 37 knots. And while there wasn't really any consistency between them on trials, the reported speeds on trials varied from 4.5 all the way up to 8 knots faster than they were actually supposed to do. So the slowest of them, remember design speed 37 knots, the slowest of them was reported to have clocked in at just over 41 knots, and the fastest of them somehow managed to pull off almost 45. So yeah, that was a pretty darn impressive, although as you can tell from this picture of Le Terrible at speed, they were definitely going semi-planing at that point. But then what do you expect? You're talking about a power output greater than that of a Queen Elizabeth class battleship in its modified state, stuffed into a small destroyer. Well, not a small destroyer, but a small ship that was a destroyer. Colby Pup Gaming asks, for my partner's curiosity, based on how violently British your name is, if you're given a choice of hot beverage and accompanying snack, what would it be? Well, now that's difficult, because my preferred choice of hot beverage is hot chocolate, but I don't really go for snacks along with hot chocolate, especially because I go for extremely sweet hot chocolate. Accompanying snack, see, my very preferred snack, if you were going to give me a snack, would be a bacon sandwich. That doesn't really go well with hot chocolate. If I was going to have a hot drink with a bacon sandwich, I'd probably go for a good cup of Bovril. Admittedly, Bovril is something I've only really tried all that much in the last few years, but it is very, very nice. So yeah, that would be my choice in those cases. Will Sanders asks, Drac, would kit bashing the surplus 8-inch 45 caliber Mark 6-2 gun turrets off of the late American pre-dreadnoughts onto a Tennessee-class armoured cruiser hull, and then installing actual fire control, more efficient boilers, and converting the coal bunkers into a torpedo defence system actually work? With their armour and size paired with 8 8-inch guns, they'd be a fairly tough nut to crack for anything short of a Scharnhorst or a Congo to bully, and without aspirations of more speed, they'd be fairly cheap to convert. Would it give the US and its allies worthwhile convoy escorts, or would it just consume a bunch of resources shifting second-line parts around? In some ways, this is similar to a plan that was drawn up in the immediate aftermath of the Washington Naval Treaty, when the Tennessees were allowed to be retained, which called for much of the same, you know, new fire control systems, switch to oil firing, torpedo defenses, etc., etc. The main difference is that the schemes in the early 20s and again in the late 20s looked at replacing the twin 10-inch turrets with triple 8-inch using the newest US Navy 8-inch guns. Otherwise, it's pretty much like for like, with the exception that the historical plans also looked at essentially inverting the bow. As you can see here, the Tennessee class had a sloped back bow, and the idea was to remodel the bow to have a forward rake and a flare. And they estimated that with the new improved power plants, they could probably get the ships up to around about 25, 26 knots. So still not full heavy cruiser speed, but a little bit quicker than they historically were. So with that said, the main reasons that the ideas were abandoned were firstly it was cost, but it was almost entirely based around cost, because sure, the US had more than enough industry to do it, but in the middle of the 1920s, the US Navy didn't have the budget to do it and continue to build new cruisers. So they decided, in the interest of having the most optimal amount of ship for the money that they had, they were going to spend that money on newer heavy cruisers, which could obviously carry a similar armament and be considerably faster, more purpose-built for that speed, etc. And sure, they might not have quite the same level of protection in parts as a Tennessee class, but they thought the speed would be of much greater utility. Now, the problem is, if you fast forward to the late stages of the 1930s, only one of the ships is even still around anymore. So if you're going to do this conversion as a group, you are going to need to do it in the 1920s, which means you're going to have to persuade the Navy to, well, you're going to have to persuade Congress to give the Navy more money, and then you're going to have to persuade the Navy that that money is specifically to be spent on these ships. Now, of course, that's not necessarily entirely out of the question, in that the US Congress can mandate that, yes, we are giving you this amount of money to various US government departments, and it must be spent on this particular thing. So if a congressman or two had got a particular bee in their bonnet about the class, they could have provided the necessary funds. But I think at that point, putting in four twin old-school 8-inch turrets would probably be a step too far for the US Navy, simply because you'd have to install two new sets of magazines, reduce the size of the existing ones, punch completely different sets of holes into the hull to accommodate the turrets, and do all sorts of fancy calculations. And at the end of the day, the 8-inch 45 had been superseded. Even if you modified the turrets for increased elevation, it would still have been superseded by the newer 8-inch 55. So I think the rest of it is potentially practicable. But if they were then going to rearm it from having 10-inch guns, I think they're more likely to go with the idea of putting triple 8-inch turrets in place of the twin 10s, with the newer, longer range and greater firepower 8-inch guns, rather than completely rework the hull for four turrets of questionable utility. Or if they were going to do that, then in terms of having more firepower and saving some cost, it might be more beneficial at that point, rather than coming up with some old 8-inch 45 caliber turrets, to maybe, because they can shorten up the machinery space, would maybe be to put in an additional triple turret, which would give you a 9-gun broadside, which would be more than four twins, but perhaps you could have a super firing rear turret, because that there's more space there, and it would be easier to do than relocating the entire forward superstructure. So that might be a compromise for maximal firepower that could then work out. And yes, at that point, those ships could be relatively useful convoy escorts. And especially if you replace the extensive secondary battery that you can see here along the side with just a single deck of 5-inch guns, you could justify it initially in the way that they were looking at justifying it in the 20s, which was essentially as a fleet escort against attacking destroyers. And then obviously in the late 30s, you could go, okay, well, the fleet's getting faster, we don't need them there. But, you know, they're really handy sailing as solo escorts for convoys against potential merchant raiders, or even, you know, full-size commerce raiders. So something like this conversion would be able to quite easily stand off against a Hipper class and would have a decent shot, at least, at doing enough damage to a Deutschland to make them be significantly deterred from trying in the first place. Elite Corsair asks, if the Americans had taken 1944 Admiral Spruance's wish to heart and struck straight for Iwo Jima and Okinawa as soon as possible in late 44, i.e. around October, instead of going after the Philippines, in your opinion, how do you think the Japanese and their Navy in particular would have reacted? I think you would have seen a considerably stronger reaction from the Japanese fleet, because obviously when it came to the historical invasion of the Philippines, you have this very complicated three-prong plan, which to a certain extent is taking advantage of the geography of the Philippines and the fact that there are multiple ways to get from the western side to the eastern side, and hence you have the northern force, the centre force, and the southern force. And that's kind of the last gasp of the Imperial Japanese Navy as a major organized surface force. However, if instead of going after the Philippines, the US Navy rocks up off of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, that gives the Japanese some advantages and some disadvantages. So disadvantage, obviously, both Iwo Jima and Okinawa are pretty small islands. So there's no real geography that serves to easily indicate, well, we should put a decoy force here, and our actual strike force here. So any approach is going to be significantly more obvious. The flip side to that is, of course, it's going to be a lot closer a distance for Japanese fleet units to travel, at least if they're traveling from the Japanese homeland. Obviously, historically speaking, during the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the Japanese were bringing ships in from all sorts of places across their remaining holdings. But I think you can relatively reasonably suggest that had Iwo Jima and Okinawa come under attack, the Japanese probably would have relocated the bulk of their fleet to the home islands or close to it in very short order, because unlike the Philippines, which were in the end occupied territory, Iwo Jima and Okinawa were very much considered to be part of the core holdings of Japan. They're not the home islands, but they're kind of part of them to a degree, in the sense that they're some of the holdings the Japanese had at the beginning of the war and had held for quite a while. And so at that point, I think you probably would have seen the Japanese group everything together, maybe with one token decoy force, and then gone straight for the landings as hard as possible, kind of in a similar way to what Yamato historically was supposed to do when it came to the eventual landings in Iwo Jima and Okinawa in 1945, except with considerably more ships. Obviously, to a certain extent, they would have some air cover from Japan and some of the other nearby islands. And if I was the Japanese commander, I'd also be tempted to get a number of aircraft or carrier aircraft and carrier qualified pilots in fighters, and have at least 2-3 flight decks going with the main fleet, purely to provide fighter cover for as long as those fighters last. Maybe you still use some of the flight decks as a decoy force, because there's no way at that point that you can actually fill all of the flight decks. But if you have a smaller token decoy force, only use some of your carriers for that, I would say, and have at least a modicum of air cover. Because at the end of the day, when you're looking at the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the idea is to draw the American forces away as much as possible. And for that, you do need a big decoy force, hence obviously why they're using all their carriers there. For this kind of thing, however, you're relying as much on the fact that you can make a mad dash from home waters to the landings, and there's only going to be so much you can do to distract the Americans and draw off their main forces, at which point you need to be able to have just enough air cover to last maybe a day or even half a day, because that can buy you enough time to get close enough for a surface action to become a major problem. Packer910 asks, how much more powerful was the 5-inch 54 caliber compared to the 5-inch 38, and how much of a difference would it have made if introduced on the Iowas and the Essexes? There's quite a lot of variety depending on exactly what measure you're looking at. So, for example, in terms of rate of fire, the 5-inch 54 doesn't offer a real significant boost in terms of rate of fire compared to the 5-inch 38. In fact, the 5-inch 38 can, times burst fire a little bit faster than the 5-inch 54 can, but with the new advanced loading mechanisms, the main difference is the 5-inch 54 can just keep up that rate of fire for basically as long as you need to. In terms of range, again, there's a variety of ways of looking at it. So for roughly the same flight time of shell, around 63 to 64 seconds, the 5-inch 54 can send around another 6,000 yards downrange. So the maximum range of a 5-inch 38 is around about 18,000 yards. And for that, it needs to be elevated at almost exactly 45 degrees. Whereas for the 5-inch 54, it can achieve basically the same range at an elevation of only just over 18 degrees. And it cuts almost half a minute off of the flight time. And to go that extra 6,000 yards, it's still only elevated at about 24 degrees, although then it has the same kind of flight time with that extra 6,000-yard range. And it can go up to about 26,000 yards, although that extends the flight time of the shell to well over a minute. So as an anti-surface weapon, it's going to be somewhat more powerful because it can reach out to a given range faster. So your fire control calculation is a little bit less difficult, and it's going to be hitting slightly harder when it gets there most of the time. But also, it's a much more valuable long-distance anti-aircraft weapon because although for most practical ranges, most practical elevations, its ability to reach altitude is not massively dissimilar to the 5-inch 38, the big difference is that those maximum heights can be reached considerably further out than with a 5-inch 38. So to give some idea, the 5-inch 38, if you want to reach up to the high 20,000s of feet, you need to be elevating the thing up to over 60 degrees, which obviously means that, yes, you can engage an aircraft that's flying at 27, 28, 29,000 feet, but only in a relatively narrow circle around the fleet, which of course means high altitude recon aircraft and stuff that are some distance away you might not be able to engage. Whereas to reach a similar kind of altitude with the 5-inch 54, you only need to elevate to about 47, 48 degrees, which of course means that for a target at that altitude, you can fire out considerably further, which is obviously quite a valuable thing to have. It means you can engage targets considerably further away, much like the 5.25 could in the latter stages of the Pacific War. The main disadvantage is that you pay for these increased capabilities in weight. So as you can see here on the Midway class, a single 5-inch 54 mount is going to mass not quite double, but maybe 80-85% more than a single 5-inch 38 mount. And at that point, although the single 5-inch 54 only weighs about as much as the absolute lightest of the twin 38s, and most twin 38 5-inch 38 mounts are going to be considerably heavier. And that means, because obviously these mounts also are taking up a certain amount of deck space, on an Iowa or an Essex class, you are going to lose barrel count, even if you're not going to lose half your barrel count, because by weight, certainly you could get a similar number of 5-inch 54s compared to the heaviest of the 5-inch 38s, which you'd find on an Iowa, for instance. But you're just physically not going to have enough deck space for 20 single 5-inch 54s compared to 10 twin 5-inch 38s. So would it make a huge difference? I don't think so for the majority of the ship's service. Where you might make some difference would be right at the end of the Pacific War, once the Japanese have gotten kind of the measure of the 5-inch 38, and they do have those scouts, recons, and even strike aircraft that are patrolling just outside the 5-inch 38's range and hoping the combat air patrol doesn't show up. At which point, perhaps having some of the latest US ships equipped with those 5-inch 54 mounts might allow you to get some surprise strikes in at ranges that the Japanese aren't expecting. But where the additional abilities of the 5-inch 54 really come into its own is when you're dealing with faster, higher performance attack aircraft like you'll have in the immediate post-World War II era, which for the most part the Japanese don't have. Stephen Palmer asks, were the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau subject to the Versailles Treaty 11-inch gun restrictions when they were designed? When they were designed, yes, they were, because although they were blatantly breaking the Versailles Treaty limit that said that Germany could only build up to 10,000-ton ships, because, well, look at them, they are quite clearly well above 10,000 tons, having the 11-inch armament, which was one of the other things that they were limited to, was done in part by Hitler as an attempt to appease the British, essentially saying, look, I'm not intending to build a big battle fleet to counter your battle fleet. And yes, these ships are considerably larger than the 10,000-ton limit that the Versailles Treaty says. However, they are still only armed with 11-inch guns. And, well, an 11-inch gun ship is obviously clearly no match for a 15-inch gun ship or a 16-inch gun ship. Therefore, they're no threat to the Royal Navy. By the time it comes to actually building them, at that point, Hitler has concluded the Anglo-German Naval Agreement. And so when the keels are laid down, the Scharnhorsts are, at least by the terms of that agreement, obviously the French are not particularly keen on it, but by the terms of that agreement, once keels are laid down, the Scharnhorsts are now no longer subject to the Versailles restrictions and within the scope of the Anglo-German Naval Agreement, completely legal. Of course, the Bismarcks then go along and break that, because part of the Anglo-German Naval Agreement is that the Germans will respect the restrictions and limitations of other existing naval treaties, like the London Naval Treaty at the time. And of course, while the Scharnhorsts do tick the boxes for capital ships under those naval treaties and agreements, the Bismarcks definitely don't. Benius Valhalla asks, in the US Navy, the first ship of its class is numbered 1. What are the names of the first US Navy battleship, destroyer, heavy light cruiser, submarine, etc., etc.? Well, this can lead to some rather interesting scenarios, because if you're looking at what was the first modern American steel battleship, most historians would say it would be USS Texas, built in the very late 1880s and early 1890s. However, by hull classification, USS Indiana, as seen here, would be the first US battleship officially recognized by the US Navy, although that was obviously codified a little bit later. The US initially would call her battleship number 1, then it was B1, then it was BB1. So it was in some ways a little bit retroactive. But officially speaking, USS Indiana is the first US Navy modern steel battleship. Although, as I said, most people would probably give that honor to Texas if you're ignoring the hull numbers. In terms of battle cruisers, or shall we say battle cruiser adjacent designs, you actually have two starting points. Theoretically, USS Lexington, being the first of her class, would be the first official US Navy battlecruiser had she ever been completed. She was designated CC-1, but then she wasn't completed as that. She was eventually completed as a carrier, and she became CV-2 because, of course, CV-1 was USS Langley. And then, of course, you get into the Alaska class, which, as I said, they're really super large cruisers, but they're given a designation as CB. And if you want to count them as a battlecruiser adjacent style ships, well, Alaska was CB-1. And then we move down to cruisers. So the first official American armored cruiser is the Maine, which obviously exploded and kicked off the Spanish-American War. That was ACR-1. And similar to the battleship scenario, there are a bunch of modern-ish steel cruisers that the US Navy builds before they officially acknowledge things with hull numbers. So the very first official US cruiser, or you sort of a light cruiser, it's the protected cruiser category at that point, but compared to the armored cruiser, you would say it's the smaller of the two types, would be USS Newark, which is C-1. And then the whole thing gets reset a couple of times. So, of course, you have the Chester class in the 1900s, which are CS-1. And initially, the Omahas fall under this category, which is the scout cruiser category. Then they redesignate everything cruiser-wise to CA, which is initially armored cruisers, and CL for light cruisers. So they don't actually have a CA-1, but they have a CA-2, which is the former ACR-2, originally USS New York, by that point USS Rochester. USS Chester then goes from CS1 to CL1, and that's why later on you'll see the Omahas with CL hull numbers. The pre-World War I USS Bainbridge is DD1, the first US officially acknowledged destroyer, and USS Holland, SS1, is the first officially acknowledged US submarine, at least for the SS hull number. Like with some of the other hull designations, there are a bunch of other hull numbers suggested for various types of submarine early on, but for the one that you want to carry on through World War I, World War II, and into the present day, i.e. the SS hull number, Holland is your go-to. And finally for this week, Nick Brodar asks, have you heard of Jeff Wayne's musical War of the Worlds, and what do you think of the Thunderchild battle? I actually really like it. This is one of the sort of musical tracks, I guess you'd call it, that I've listened to repeatedly for years and years on end. In fact, it's actually one of my minor regrets. I've never actually gone to see the full stage musical production in London. I say over in London, it's like I live just outside of London, so I probably should have done at some point, and hopefully I will do in the near future, but for whatever reason thus far, I haven't done so. And, you know, as far as a musical adaptation of the whole thing, it works really well. And I think actually, particularly the Thunderchild battle, the intonation of the narration and the way that the whole thing flows actually works really, really well in bringing to life kind of the drama and the nature of that action compared to perhaps just a cold reading of the book. And that brings us to an end for the dry dock for this week. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.